מאזינים לשידור ישיר ממחנה רמה בברקשיירס.
כל רמה 102.3 מגישים קיץ באוויר.
רדיו כל רמה 102.3 FM.
And welcome to another edition of Park Talk. I'm Rabbi Aryeh Malman in Highland Park, on Highland Park, conservative couple of Greenwich, Don Chiamet. And joining me, my good friend, Rabbi Barry Chesler, Solomon Sheikh, the Day School of Long Island, Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanowski, Anshe Chesed of New York City. It is great to see you. We're recording this on the week before Purim. This is the week of Shabbat Zachor. And of course, we start off as we have started since Simchas Torah with remembering Zachor, Day 164 that we are recording this, and unfortunately it doesn't seem that the release of the hostage is getting any sooner, but we are sharing our anguish and our prayer, our hope, and our desire that the hostages be released as soon as they can. And we share in their anguish, we share in the things that their families are missing in them, their desire to have them back now. And thinking about how to celebrate Purim, knowing that we're in this very, very complicated time. And it brings to mind the ideas that there are many, many strategies to read the book of Esther, which is the centerpiece of Purim, despite the fact that there are four central mitzvot of Purim. The mitzvah of reading the Megillah constitutes, I think, the central mitzvah of Purim, in addition to Matanot Levyonim, Mishloach Manot, and Seudat Purim, the gifts to the poor, giving gifts to each other, and having a Seuda for Purim, reading the Megillah twice, evening and morning. And it's read with great seriousness, but it's read with also great frivolity. And so we want to spend some time thinking about these two main aspects or main valences around the reading. Let's do the serious one first, since we're serious, three serious people. Reading Megillah, I'll put the proposition on the table, which is the scroll of Esther is a political essay. It is a statement on Jews and power, Jews without power, exerting power, and Jews finding a way to defend themselves when they don't have power. And of course, it's also a case study in the anti-Semitic personality. It's not proto-anti-Semitic. This is anti-Semitism at its core. The ideas, the anti-Semitic ideology is nowhere better expressed than in this story, in the personality of Haman, and in the people that he influences. So with that, let's discuss Esther as a serious essay, or maybe Esther as farce, but I'll put that on the table a little later on. So who would like to start? I'm turning to you, Rabbi Barry Chesler.
Well, thank you for the great honor. I was going to vote for Jeremy myself. But, you know, we spent actually more time talking about the book before we started recording than we normally spend talking about the Parsha before we record. And one of the things that I find striking in this year is that the Book of Esther seems a surprisingly modern book. Now, we were talking about some ideas about when Esther was written and what community it originally spoke to. And what seems to be clear is that its afterlife is perhaps more important than its original life, that it has a way of finding echoes throughout the generations since the putative story took place sometime in the Persian period, which ended, you know, with Alexander's conquest of the known world in the late 4th century before the Common Era. And it's as a modern book that I think I find it most interesting, because it's not clear what the Jewish piece is. And I happen to consult Adele Berlin's commentary, since I had to quickly find a substitute for Parshat Vayikra, which I had brought with me. And she mentions that actually it is quite a Jewish book, even though it's the most secular book in the Bible, because it's one of the only books that is dedicated to the origin of a holiday. And there are aspects of the story which illuminate Jewish identity.
Secular in the sense that I mean, we explain what you mean by being a secular.
Okay. Well, there's no religion in the book. There's no temple. Yeah. There's no prayer, except for, you know, Esther's fast, perhaps. And there's no sense of Jewish ritual anywhere in the book.
What's so fascinating, you know, just on this topic for a second, is that what is a secular book becomes essentially the cornerstone of liturgy. And not only that, but it becomes the springboard for how reading is done in Jewish life. The tractate Megillah is a tractate all about the reading of sacred scripture in as an act of worship. And so and in fact, when it comes to the observance of Purim, and I mentioned this at the beginning, you know, that the reading of the Megillah takes on, it's a holy act to read the Megillah. It's, we have blessings. And, you know, depending on where you go on the spectrum, you could go into a shul on Purim, and if there's noise, the people stop and they'll reread it. They'll reread it because the mitzvah to hear every single word of the Megillah, you know, and even when they blot out the name of Haman with noise, they'll reread the word Haman, you know, because of the punctiliousness of which we for with which we have to read it. So, in a sense, the secularity of the book gives rise to a hyper piety in reading the book. It's fascinating.
There's a few interesting observations about the book and when it you know, came to be so important, as opposed to most of the other books in the Kituvim, in the third section of the Tanakh. You know, there's the Torah, and then there's the prophetic writings, and then you have the Kituvim, some of which we use liturgically and some of which we don't. Esther, of course, we do. Shir HaShirim and Ruth, they have a liturgical use, although we don't make nearly the big deal of them that we do of Megillat Esther. But I'll tell you one interesting fact is that in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which represents what, you know, as our listeners probably know, Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in the 1940s and 50s in the Judean desert, and they are presumably at represent a kind of a sectarian community at Qumran, in the northern part of the Dead Sea. Every biblical book is attested except Esther. There's no Esther in those fragments. Yeah. So presumably, I mean, even Shir HaShirim and stuff like that are attested. There's no Esther, and with you know, like sort of appropriate tentativity, was there a controversy about Esther? Or did some people think that this, you know, in that period of around the Great Revolt and around the you know, destruction of the temple, give or take some decades, somewhere in the first century CE, were there some people who said, what in the world is this doing in the canon? This is we'll talk later in the conversation about the sort of bawdy and naughty parts of the book. So I'm going to guess that some people didn't take this nearly so seriously. But as Barry said, this is a book about getting along in the diaspora, without those major features of Vayidaber Adonai El Moshe L'Emor, you know, that tells, here's the normative behavior, here's what we expect you to do, here's the way you live out this religion, with the exception of the post facto celebrations. That is to say, Mordechai says, sends them a letter and says, I want you to make these days of feasts, and you know, Matanot Levionim, Mishloach Manot Ishtorehu, gifts to each other, a celebration. sustenance for the poor, those are the post facto Jewish observances, but not the here's how the sacred community lives, which is the way that the Torah or the prophets primarily function. So it's a book of getting along in the diaspora. It isn't in Eretz Yisrael. There's no promise like, whoa, we should go back to Eretz Yisrael. Our readers, listeners, viewers probably know that the Babylonians destroyed the temple. They were quickly destroyed by the Persians. The Persians are comparatively for us good guys. They let us come back and rebuild the temple. But this book has nothing to do with that. It doesn't say any of those things. But what it does have to say, I think, to a Jewish community is something about how it is that you relate. And Elliot, I know you have a lot to say about this. How it is that you relate to those Gentile authorities in power? How do you get along when you are a fairly powerless minority? As Haman says about them, they're the scattered people. Their ways are different. That makes us by definition vulnerable. And Mordechai and Esther, and just like another figure who, because there's no liturgical use of this, most of us don't know this book very well, but it's really important in the Bible. Daniel. Daniel is the courtier or advisor or whatever to Nebuchadnezzar, and Mordechai looks quite a bit like Daniel in this respect. So how do you live in Persia if you got no power and you're very small and you're kind of weak? And so it is, as you were alluding to, and I know you have some ideas about this, a reflection of that problem.
So I want to underscore this. And I think, perhaps one of the reasons why it's not in the Dead Sea just is it's a diaspora book. And the sentiment of this book, the worldview of this book is outside the land and exile. And in fact, just to pull out a couple of verses, when we chant it and we discuss we read the items, it's already in the first chapter, the items in the party, right? The Vashkot Bichle Zahav, it's verse 6. They were drinking out of the golden goblets. Traditional reading, cantillates that in Echatrop because of the tradition that the vessels were stolen from the temple and they were brought into the diaspora. And that's I want to go as far as saying that's a folk idea. That's built into the whole book. The idea that here we are outside the land, looking towards the land, and we are finding whatever thing we can find to connect this to the land. And the next one is where it's Ishi Udiya, chapter 2, the introduction of Mordechai, which the congregation recites, and then it's repeated by the reader. Ishi Hudi, there was a Jew. Ishi Hudi Ayab Shushan Abirah Shmor Mordechai. There was a Jew in Shushan, the capital. His name was Mordechai, son of Yair, son of Shimi, son of Kish, man of Yemen, a Benjaminite. Asher Hagla Mirushalayim Imagola Asher Hoglata Yechanya Melech Yuda Asher Hagla Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. He was part of the dispersed Jews. He was exiled. That's, we traditionally chant that in Echa. You want to tear your clothing when that is chanted. And so here
we come. It should be pointed out that Mordechai is descended or said to descend from King Saul's family, not from King David's family.
This is a great aspect of the story.
That's an important point because he's not part of the center of the Israelite or the Judean narrative. He's sort of, off center, historically speaking.
I think this is a really interesting part of the story. If you read, the books of Samuel, Shaul is very talented, but he's flawed. He gets fired. He gets replaced by David. And we like David. David's the hero. And yet there are some stories that the Shaul clans are not giving up without a fight. And this is one of them because, first of all, Shaul ultimately, his downfall is for his failure to execute Agag, the king, and Haman is Agagi, that he's seen to have descended from him. So the Shaul family gets another bite at that apple, but also he's Ben Shimi. Shimi, Ben Gera, is one of the Saulite enemies of David. So I think that the ancient, like you were saying, which one of you said, to study the Bible, I mean, you have to know the Bible to study
you have
the
to
Bible.
Know the Bible.
You have to know the Bible. So once we say he's Ben Shimi, the person who knows the Bible says, "Oh my goodness, we're back in that story."
Exactly. Well, this is redux of you know, Amalek and Israel, Benjamin and you know, Saul and Agag the Amalekite, and so that, I mean, that's a strategy for reading, and that tells you that this is a deep story, and that the deep story is, how do you deal with an enemy like this? How do you deal with the perpetual nature of anti-Jewish animus? It's something that we are living through right now. We are living through the anguish of that now. It's the anguish of this moment is, in America, we thought we were beloved. We thought, you know, for the most part, we had no problem. And all of a sudden, an eruption of anti-Semitism that has taken people by surprise. And we're thinking, you know, what the eternity of this story, that there are Jews and there are people who hate Jews. And that,
Why don't you read, Elliot, why don't you read 3:8, which is Haman's speech about that.
So, Vayomer Haman LaMelech Achashverosh, Haman says to King Achashverosh, Yeshno Amechad, there's one people, Mifuzar Muforad Ben Amim, spread and scattered throughout all the nations, Bechol Medinot Malchutecha, in all of your provinces, V'dateyam Shonot, their laws, their ways are different, Mikolam, from every nation, V'datey HaMelech Enam Osim, they don't do the king's ways. But HaMelech Ein Shoveh LaHanicham, and it won't cost anything for the king to dispatch them, right? And that's it. That line is the epitome of anti-Jewish animus. They're different. They're spread out. Their ways are different. And we're never going to assimilate them. We're never going to make, they're never going to be part of us.
But that's that issue of difference. You know, like, it's, of course, one can't be too anachronistic, but like Barry said, there's so many modern resonances, and that claim that you guys are just so different. Why can't you just be, you know, universally human like all the rest of us? Paul, the Christian, Rabbi Shaul Ish Tarshish, who was a Pharisee who became Jesus's right-hand, he never met Jesus personally, but Paul of Tarsus becomes, you know, St. Paul. He says, I'm forgetting the citation in the Christian Bible, but he says, there is no male nor female, nor slave nor free, nor Jew nor Greek, just oneness in Christ. So, like, this is the argument, the Jews are just too different. Can't you just be universal? But the universal is always never universal. It's always particular to the people who are saying it. So you just stop being different, just stop being so different and just be like us.
That tension exists within Jews themselves. Jews want to be like everybody else.
So it's interesting, you know, when you were talking, I was thinking about the line from Bilam, who says about the Israelites that there are people who dwells alone. And that's true in the land, almost, so to speak. Here in the diaspora, the spread of the Jews, you know, when you were reading it, I was thinking of the image that came to mind was of a disease spreading amongst the people, that the Jews somehow embody a disease and their spread is going to kill the people that they infect.
Right.
Well, which, you know, only heightens the sense of the anti-Semitic trope.
And so this book is a political book. It's a political book that has at its core this anti-Jewish animus, and this has at its core a Jewish desire for survival in powerlessness. And strategies for that, which include being able to listen carefully to the murmurings in the palace, to look for the different ways that you can influence, to look for weaknesses, and to be able to be a kind of protective layer for power when the power itself is not quite full. I'm thinking Mordecai's role in the book is, and Mordecai's great heroism at the beginning of the book is that he saves Achashverosh. He saves Ahasuerus because he overhears Bigtan and Teresh plotting to assassinate the king. And even that tells you something, that there is a moment of subterfuge in the palace where two palace, you know, elites are thinking that they could overthrow the king through an assassination. And Mordecai brings that information to the attention that it needs to get, and these two people are tried and executed. And then that piece of information ends up saving the Jews. And maybe that's a good way to segue into the so to speak, I don't want to say farcical nature of it, but the comedy of the book is that we do have a string of events that link up in the most unusual way, and therefore our reaction to them is laughter, right? Our reaction to them is, at the beginning you could read the opening chapters, the overture to the story as the serious decay of corruption and misogyny, or you can see it as farce. I'm of two minds of this. I think this is possibly the strategy to read it, which is schizophrenia. We read it on one side of our brain, learning the precarious nature of Jewish presence in diaspora powerlessness, and we read it with the only way that we can, which is that this is a farce and humor, and that, yeah, can you believe that they would ever command women to listen to their husbands? I mean, it's a joke.
I'm doubling down on the farce reading. I think that the farce reading, to me, well, everything that we said about the political realities and powerlessness in the diaspora and trying to forge good relationships with the king, all that is obviously part of the story. And it is a sex farce with all kinds of hysterical elements. You know, the tragedy is like, I think this is somewhere in the world's literature, like tragedy is when the mighty fall low and comedy is when the low rise high, right? So when you don't expect the weak losers turn out to be the big time winners, which is what we have in the story. And there's drunkenness throughout. There's naughty, sexy stuff throughout.
Innuendo? Innuendo and not innuendo. I mean,
not very, very veiled innuendo, like, or hardly veiled innuendo. Like, after the king throws Vashti out, and they decide that they're going to have a contest to who can be the new king, new queen. They gather every virgin, every beautiful virgin throughout the kingdom. Each of them has one full year of bathing in perfume, and then she goes for her tryout in the night and comes back the next morning. What do you suppose? Like, there's, like, you know, musical competitions, and what do you suppose was happening there? And the story, I mean, it's ineluctable to say that the story is that Esther uses her sexiness to sleep with the king to become the queen. And this is, for a Jewish girl, this is you know, our beloved story, Hayudim Bayim, the sketch comedy show in Israel that sends up stories, Bible stories and stories from Jewish history. In that story, Mordecai says, Esther, I've got a fabulous idea. They're trying to kill the Jewish people. What we're going to do, you are going to go sleep with the king. She says, excuse me, but I think you're making me out to be a prostitute. And he says, no. He says, yeah, I think you're making me out to be a prostitute. He says, in the future, little girls will want to be you. They will dress. They will want to dress up like Queen Esther. And she says, like a prostitute? He says, only in high school.
Okay. Because it's so serious. It's so serious. Okay. He loves her. Vayehav Hamelech et Esther.
Well, she is awesome. I mean, she's a great character. She is awesomely powerful. And the sexy part, you just can't take it away, right? And there is the nasty, the naughty jokes of like, I'm sure all of our listeners are grown-ups here. So she can't go into the king because when you show up into the king's chamber, he must extend the golden scepter. What does this stand for? He's trying to compensate for something. And Haman stands firm. And there's another joke because Haman, first of all, there's lots of humor. Like Haman, the king says, what is the best way to honor somebody? And Haman says, well, he's talking about me. So he says he'll lead him through the city and he'll ride the king's horse and he'll wear the king's clothes. And Ahasuerus says, that's a great idea. That's what we're going to do to Mordechai. Oh, and Haman is forced to lead Mordechai through the city to great acclaim. And there's another dirty joke when Haman, in hopes of executing Mordechai, builds a 50 amah, that's like, 10 story tall, gallows to hang Mordechai on. And then when Haman gets caught, his running mate Harbona says, well, we got this 50 cubit high gallows. Oh, hang him on that. So everything is turned upside down. And in fact, the vibe of the holiday of Purim, and I in a sense, I'm reading this book, not only in what it says in Megillat Esther, but in the way that it is encoded in the fun, dress-up, drunkenness holiday of Purim, like all societies, like Mardi Gras, like Carnival in Rio, springtime holidays tend to be holidays of inverting all the norms and going a little wild and having fun. That's the way we observe Purim. And so to me, a book full of sex jokes, dirty jokes, drunkenness, and the lowly people turn out to best the people who would have tried to kill them. I cannot read this book except as a the other stuff is there too, but the main vibe to me of this book is comedy.
No, so I don't want to be too pious here because I'm not. But
go ahead.
No, I want to preserve the piety and the. There's something appealing about a scandalous reading of this. Okay, that everything you said is true. On the other hand, what makes it deeply resonant is that a lot of life is like this, and we do have enemies, and that we love to see our enemies hoisted on their own petard, and we do experience the reversal of events in ways that are simply inexplainable. And we do marvel at ingenuity and chance and being at the right place at the right time. And the moment that Mordechai says, which is really one of the great themes of the book, where he says to Esther, You can't be silent now. This is something that you need to do. You need to think about. You need to act. And who knows if this is the reason why you have gotten to this high office. It's a very powerful idea that resonates beyond, just that scene. It resonates down to this time, which is, how many of us have used that as a kind of, sermon idea or an inspiration to say, You just don't know. You don't know at what point you've been called upon to show up to something. And that's what life is. Life is you have to show up. I mean, how many fundraisers, how many, projects do we do is say, you don't know if this is the one. And I think that's a deep truth. And of course it's, there's layers that are just kind of enveloping this. There's humor, there's tawdriness, there's a lot of bodiness, but there's that deep serious core to this.
I want to add something, and that there's an element of triumphalism in the story as well. And when Mordechai says, who knows where help might come from, it's because he believes that they will succeed no matter what. And Esther could be part of the success or not, but the success of the Jewish mission, so to speak, is guaranteed. And one of the, I think, striking parts of this story is that the Megillah explains the origin of this holiday of Purim, which from the story originates in the diaspora, but a few centuries after the Dead Sea Scrolls is part and parcel of the Mishnah, the rabbi's construction of Judaism. And so it became a religion, a holiday, I mean, for Israel, the land of Israel, as well as the diaspora. And the last thing in this regard is that Purim and the Megillah reminds us that there has to be an element of fun in religion. It can't be all seriousness. And Purim speaks to that fun because you have to enjoy it. If you can't enjoy Purim, you're in the wrong religion.
Well,
when I want to double down on the humor thing, it really weaves together beautifully with what both of you guys just said about, you know, a lot of life is like that. Religion, this is like famously, this is the book that does not mention God except obliquely in that Mordechai to Esther speech, you know, that revach v'hatzalah ya'amod la'yehudim mimakom acher, that salvation will come to the Jewish people from somebody other than you, unless you step up. And as you just said, umi yodea im la'ed kazot higata malchut, maybe this is part of the plan. There's a great perfect finished plan. And maybe this is your role. The reality of like a lot of religious life, okay, you open up the Torah, God says to Moses, I'm going to appear and I'm going to tell you things directly, and there's going to be a clear and evident order. I'm not going out on a limb to say that the way we live in the world, for the most part, that is not true. And there are a lot of more Hamans in the world and a lot more threats in the world. And the human ingenuity and the ability to laugh. There's a Nachman of Breslov story, an amazing story in which the sort of this fable character is visiting the kingdom of lies, and he learns that the secret of how you puncture the kingdom of lies is to laugh at it. And so this is a deep Jewish response to an upside down world, that a terrible king who doesn't rule his kingdom very well, who's basically a drunken buffoon with his villainous advisor, that's the world. And if you can laugh at it, you can turn it upside down and you can make it better. So I see in the farce part, like a deep Jewish laughing at the kingdom of lies.
So I would try and draw a line from that to what we see in even in Israeli comedy that is appearing now. Many of you may have seen some of the skits of Eretz Nehederet, the Israeli satire show, which has Yichya Sinwar, the Hamas leader. You know, he's costumed with big ears with as a mouse, and he's in a tunnel, and there's a lot of satirizing of the leadership of Hamas, and a lot of satirizing, by the way, of America and American anti-Semitism, and a lot of the things that we saw earlier on in the demonstration, the pro-Palestinian demonstrations on the left, and from the Israeli, by poking fun at it, they're exerting power over it, they're containing it, and they really are ridiculing it, and they're. And I think part of what we have here in the character of Haman is that the arch enemy is a droll, clownish, buffoon caricature of himself because of the lies that he perpetuates. I mean, I can't help but go back and forth from the farcical to the seriousness of it, and that's. I think that's also an authentic Jewish reading of it. I don't think we live in one or the other. I think we are saying l'chaim, we're drinking to this, but we're also seeing the depth of the truth of it, too. I don't know.
Simchat Purim, baby.
Absolutely. No, it's so important. Well, I think, you know, complicated time, but important to have that. As you know, we had it at the beginning. How to navigate Simchas Torah, and now we're approaching this, and of course celebrate, of course get together, of course rejoice, and to the future and to the eternity of this story that really resonates with us deeply now. And we all need a lift also. And this is a lift for us. Give you joy, everyone, to wish, first of all, a good Shabbos to everyone as we conclude this time. And Saturday night, Purim, after Shabbos, enjoy, wear your costume, read the Megillah, give to the poor, Mishloach Manot, and also have a nice feast. And think about everybody. There's plenty of things, there's lots of material online also on how to make this particular Purim a meaningful Purim. Just look for it. And with that, I want to leave you all with these wishes of good Purim, speaking of Klal Yisrael. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Purim. Shabbat Shalom.
Bye. On the next edition of Parsha.
FM.